This morning, what we want to discuss is an overview of the third 500 years of the history of the church. This would be called the late Middle Ages. In our timeline that we looked at earlier and an overview, we know that the period from 30 AD up to approximately 590, we can call ancient church history, the medieval church history in the middle from approximately, some people date it 590, I date it 500, up obviously to the beginning of modern church history, which is characterized by the time of the Reformation. In the earlier periods, we discussed the Apostolic Church, the Fathers, the Church Councils, the Golden Age of Church Fathers, where we talked about the ones in the East, the Cappadocian Fathers. In this middle period, we have talked about popes, the rise of the Holy Roman Empire. We're going to talk about the Crusades, the papacy in decline, the pre-reformers. Then in the modern era, well, we'll get to that. That's next year. Another way to look at the second 500 years as a matter of review, what did we cover in that second 500 years? Essentially, you can say this. Really, the significant thing was the decline and fall of Rome. Rome was invaded by the Huns. This is a map that Doug had used that I absconded. This is the different movements of the Franks, the Goths, the Visigoths, the Ostrogoths, all coming against Rome. Some of these, you remember, were Christians, such as the Vandals down in North Africa here. These were Arian Christians. And so this presented a real challenge, like to Augustine as he considered this. These are Christians who are at the gates of my city to overrun my city. Well, by the 5th century, the Roman Empire, as it was known, had collapsed. Now, in this period of 500 years, we can discuss the place of Christianity. What constituted Christianity? You could talk about the Romans. The popes. You had great popes at this time. Gregory the Great, Leo the Great, the first pope that you would consider a pope in the fact that he exerted and attempted to exert and succeeded in exerting his influence over the majority of the known church. Now, they resisted his influence in the East in Constantinople, which we discussed last week, but Leo attempted to mediate in matters, so he was the first man that you would really call a pope. The first great pope is Gregory the Great in 590. Gregory, I do believe, is a godly man. He instituted some reforms, some patterns of operation. He had a manual for the priest to operate under and with that was a very good manual of church order. Gregory was very interested in missionary things. He is the one that sent Augustine to England when he saw the little Anglo-Saxon boy that was being sold as a slave, and he wondered where he came from. Gregory was very involved and very favorable for missions. In this period of the second 500 years, we know that the Christianity spread to areas where it had not been before. We discussed the spread to England, to Ireland, to Scotland, Ireland obviously with Patrick, and the amazing conversion of Ireland. I mean, it really was amazing when you consider that this was an island of backward people that still sacrificed not only animals, but possibly humans. I mean, they were that enraptured in darkness. And within 100 years, light had invaded that island. That is a marvelous thing. And from that island, it then spread to Scotland. And the Scottish people that we look, some of us as our ancestors really, were the Irish that came to Scotland, and they were called the Scots. And then the development from that and missionaries were sent out. I found last night my map where I showed how Columbus and Columbanus got down into Europe. Couldn't find it the other week when I was doing this thing, but at least I found the map. So if the Lord lets me teach in 2 years, I'll have that map again. But out of Scotland and out of Ireland, you had missionaries going down into the main part of Europe carrying the gospel message. The Irish were responsible for preserving culture and the fact that the monks in the Irish monasteries copied classical literature. They copied it, and it was preserved when some of it was being lost in the continent. Another spread of Christianity, which we discussed last week, and the spread of Orthodoxy, was the spread up into the Balkans and over into Russia. And we'll mention that again, because the spread into Russia really goes into the third 500 years, which is significant, that we'll get to in a few minutes. But while Christianity was spreading, the great leader, Charlemagne, cannot forget him, and the Carolingian dynasty, and the revival of Charlemagne, and the revival of learning, and the establishments of schools, etc. But while Christianity was spreading, while it was being revived, in a sense, under Charlemagne, it was under threat. It was under a threat from the south. We know who that would be: Muslims. Islam had arisen in the 7th century. By the end of the 7th century, Islam had spread, as it shows on this map here. Islam begins here. You see the area at the end of the time of Muhammad, the area that's in the dark. Within the next 20-some years, its territory had extended to where you see this umber color. Then, up till 750, it extended all the way through the Iberian Peninsula and was going up into France, or Gaul, as it was called at the time. We know that the spread of Islam was stopped in Gaul at the Battle of Tours in 732. Very, very significant battle. I wish I could remember where to send you to read the account of it that I found to be the best. I remember these accounts, I just don't remember where I read them. But it's very interesting to see God's hand of providence when you read the account of actually how they faced off, because the Muslim forces did not take their normal tactic of advance at this battle. And they literally walked into a massacre from the forces of Martin of Tours. And it was, you can't ascribe that to anything but providential when you see that, because they did not go to the attack their normal way. And the way they went to the attack, they were slaughtered and they were pushed back. But Islam kept its hold in the Iberian Peninsula. It kept its hold throughout North Africa. So the threat from the south did not go away for the church. The threat for the south was always there. Also, we talked about the growth and the collapse of Christianity in the Orient at this time. The church in the East could be thought of in three ways. You had the Nestorian church, which was in Persia, that's present-day Iran and Iraq. The Nestorian church followed the teachings of the Bishop Nestoria, who was in Byzantine or Constantinople. He had a form of Christianity that was a little variant from Chalcedonian or Orthodoxy, but the Nestorians were not heretics by any stretch of the imagination. They were evangelical believers. Chalcedonian Orthodoxy in Constantinople that we talked about last week, that was where the condition of the church was. But how about further? How about the church in China? Doug talked about this when he reviewed this period of the spread of Christianity to China, the establishment at the time of the Tang Dynasty. The Tang Dynasty controlled all of this area. While the leaders of the Tang Dynasty may not have been Christians themselves, they were favorable to Christianity. Christianity was able to expand to the point that visitors sent from Italy over there found an established church. Unfortunately, at the end of the period, as the Tang Dynasty collapsed, Christianity collapsed. We'll discuss that in a little bit. The church also in India, we talked about the early church getting there, possibly from the Apostle Thomas. We know the church was established in the southwest coast of India. That church remained through this second 500-year period. In fact, it remained through the next 500-year period. How about the church in Africa? To talk about the church in Africa in the first period, you'd have to talk about survival. North Africa was lost to Islam, but Egypt was able to maintain a dual religion. They had a Coptic church, which was a monophysite understanding of the nature of Christ, but a Coptic church, which is a real church, and it coexisted with Islam in Egypt. It coexists actually with Islam today, even though it's gotten much, much smaller, and its existence is very troubled. There is an existence of a church that's the Coptic church. You have Coptic churches here in the United States because the immigration of the Egyptian Copts who have established, and they have their own patriarch and their order of churches here. So the church was established, remained in Egypt, but it was a very dualistic, mixed type of thing. The Nubian Christianity, we talked about the Christianity came into the area of which is present-day Sudan, and it was established not from the leaders, but from the common people, and it rose up. And it became and remained a vibrant Christianity through that second period. Ethiopian Christianity, though, was the most vital and vibrant form of Christianity found in Africa. And we'll speak about it in a few minutes. Ethiopian Christianity remained, and it was something that was really to be commended. Okay, that is a review of this first 500 years of the Middle Ages, or the second 500 years of the church. Some people have called this the Dark Ages. Doug asked the question when he went through the introduction of this many weeks ago. Were these the Dark Ages? It would be more accurate to use the term Dark Ages to refer to the last decade or decade and a half of this period, approximately 850 to 900 to the year 1000. Right in there was an area and a time that you could call the Dark Ages. With the near approach of the year 1000, obviously people began to get nervous. Can we relate to that? I don't think that they thought that their hard drives were going to shut down or whatever it was, but they were certainly sure something bad was going to happen. They wondered what would happen when that fateful year came. Charles Williams, writing in The Descent of the Dove, says, "In the eyes of Christendom, everyone expected the end. People thought it would be the end of everything." Williams also wrote, "The end did not come. The first millennium of Christianity closed, and the second opened with no greater terrors than ordinary robberies, murders, rapes, burnings, wars, massacres, and plagues." So people sighed a sigh of relief, and life went on as usual with murders, rapes, pillages, burnings, wars, massacres, and plagues. Can we say much different for the year 2000? It was a very difficult time for Christianity, though, at the end of this millennium. Well, today what I want to do is to look at the late Middle Ages, or the third 500 years of the church's existence. We're going to do this in an overview way and talk about the majority of the things that we're going to talk about in detail in the next 7 weeks. I think that's what we have left is 7 weeks. And so I want to do an overview of this period, and then we'll return to this. In this survey, we're going to talk about Christianity in Africa and Asia. We're going to take a brief glimpse at Eastern Orthodoxy and then turn to Roman Catholicism in the West. Christianity in Africa at this period, you could use one word for it, the word survival. It certainly didn't thrive, it didn't grow, but it did manage to survive. The Christian church in Egypt, which would have been mainly around the Nile in this area, as we've already said, was the Coptic church. It survived despite great disadvantages from the Muslim rule. This has been the fate of the Egyptian church up until today. The church was not obliterated as it was in other parts of North Africa. It continued to live on. Sometimes it lived with vigor. Sometimes it lived in decline. Nevertheless, it did survive. We talked about Nubian Christianity, or the area of Sudan. It's not clearly marked on here, but I'm pretty sure this is the area of the Sudan here because it's south of the area of Egypt at the headwaters of the Nile. Nubian Christianity in present-day Sudan reached its peak of greatness during this third 500 years. Mark Shaw, in his book, The Kingdom of God in Africa, said the moment of greatness was like a flash of a comet across the night sky. Why would you call it a flash of a comet? It's bright, and then it disappeared. Nubian Christianity not only reached its greatness during this time, but it also declined and collapsed. After the year 1500, you hear no more about Nubian Christianity until the missionaries of the 19th century take the gospel to it. Why did it decline? Why did it disappear? Two reasons. One, it had become dependent on the government. As long as the government was in power, the church in Nubia enjoyed prosperity. When the government collapsed, however, the church did as well. There's another reason that it failed to live on, and one of them, another reason, was that it was not evangelistic. It did not reach out in conversion. And one of the reasons it did not reach out to its neighbors in conversion was that the Nubian church in Nubia was engaged in the slave trade. You know, it's kind of hard to send a summer missionary on a three-week tour to the neighboring tribe when you have been going to the neighboring tribe and rounding up its people and selling it to traders. So the church was mixed in its practice, and if the church is mixed in its practice, it can have no effective outreach. Is that not a truth that has continued through the centuries? If the church is either holding hands with the state, or if the church is in its very practice encouraging evil, you might as well say that, then it cannot have an effective outreach. Ethiopia, on the other hand, was an area where Christianity not only survived, it thrived. It became a legend that inspired many other African religions and cultural and political movements in the 20th century. Ethiopia in the Middle Ages bears eloquent testimony to the fact that Christianity is deeply rooted in African history and African culture. We were privileged to have the three young girls from Kono Christian with us, and one of them was from Ethiopia. Her name was El Shaddai, and it was fascinating to talk with her that night and the next morning at breakfast, because she says, you know, Ethiopia to her is a Christian country. It has a Christian culture, and who knows how far back her roots go in Christianity. It could go back further. Her roots could go further in Christianity than some of our roots could go to it. The church has survived in Ethiopia. That's a brief overview of Christianity in Africa. Now let's look at Christianity in Asia. If you could talk about Christianity in Africa as survival, in Asia you would have to talk about growth, decline, and almost going out of existence. That was the period of Christianity in Asia. In China, we've talked about the Tang Dynasty and how it welcomed Christians through the end of the 9th century. But with the fall of the Tang Dynasty, Christianity almost disappeared for the next 300 years. It was very difficult. But Christianity revived under the rule of Kublai Khan and Mongol China. This is the area representing what Kublai Khan had control over. From Korea all the way down to Burma, in the west to the Euphrates. Kublai Khan was not a Christian, but he was a friend to Christians. There were Christians in his court, in his palace staff. We know this because when Marco Polo visited, he found Christians. He found evidences of Christianity there. There was widespread Christian presence in the Mongol court. But, as with the Tang Dynasty, this Christian influence was almost obliterated, because after the death of Kublai Khan, the next rulers of the Mongol area were not at all welcoming to Christianity. With the fall of the Mongol dynasty, the Chinese Christian church disappeared for a second time. The next 300 years, China would be isolated under the Ming dynasty. Very few Christians were left in China by 1500. While this took place in China, there were two strong Christian movements had existed. But by the end of this period, none of them existed. It's tough. Well, we also talked about the church in Persia. what happened to the Nestorian church in Persia. This is a modern, not a modern map, but a map of the Persian area. In this area of Persia, the church continued to exist, but it was mixed. Persian Christianity was clearly in decline. It was declined for several reasons. Now, it wasn't syncretic. That is, Christians in Persia did not mix their religion with cultish local things. They remained very distinct. They followed ancient Christian practices. But while it was not syncretic, it was a failure of the church in intellect, doctrine, and study. It was not an intellectual church. They did not produce leaders that wrote theology. They were not deep at all. And they also were too dependent on the state. The Mongol ruler of Persia in 1295 converted to Islam after the death of Kublai Khan. When he converted to Islam, the church in Persia almost ceased to exist. It did exist, but it was very small, very small. It existed in difficult circumstances and had no influence on society. By the end of this third 500 year... Oh, wait a minute. Let me say one other thing. In Central Asia, though, back up in this area, there in Central Asia, in this area, you had the rule of Genghis Khan. Genghis Khan's area extended all the way to the Black Sea. While Genghis Khan, like his predecessor Kublai Khan, was not a Christian, he was open to Christian influence. He allowed Christians to move about in his kingdom freely. Unfortunately, at the death of Genghis Khan, a fiercely Muslim ruler named Tamerlan came on the scene. Tamerlan has been described as, quote, the scourge of God and the terror of the world. He was wicked. And Christianity virtually disappeared at this time from Central Asia. The church that existed was a very, very, very small church. You had Christians in Central Asia. You had the Byzantine Orthodox Christianity in Constantinople. But you see that in itself fell unto trouble. You had the Thomas Christians in India, but they were very small. Most of the material that I've got on anything dealing with the Asia and China and the East came from Samuel Moffat's wonderful two-volume book. I say it's wonderful. It's technical, but if you want to sit down for devotional reading, don't read it. I'd recommend it to Chuck and Dixon. Chuck got it, and a few weeks after he got it, he said, "Did you find it dry?" I said, "Dry as wheat." But I mean, the facts. Dr. Moffat is an evangelical. He was a missionary, godly man. The material in this two volumes book is, I mean, it's something that will be used for the next 200 or 300 years if the church existed, because this history is that good. But it is dry as straw when you try to read it. That was a quick overview of the 500 years of Christianity in Asia. Next, let's move to Eastern Orthodoxy. Last week, we did the whole lesson on Eastern Orthodoxy, the establishment, what was going on in Constantinople, the Byzantine Empire, and the areas that it expanded up to the Balkans. It expanded into Russia. Orthodoxy in this third 500-year period could be described by two words, gain and loss. It gained territory, it lost territory. The greatest gain was the conversion of Russia. This is a map that it's not real clear, but from Constantinople, this whole area north here, the Principality of Kiev, it called it in 1000 AD, this was the area of Russia that technically in 988, the Russian Tsar converted to Christianity. And the conversion was to the Orthodox Christianity as practiced in Constantinople, not to the Western Christianity of Rome. Orthodox Christianity expanded in Russia. We talked last week about the fact that it couldn't move south or east because of Islam. It couldn't move to the west because of Rome, but it could move to the north, and it did. The high point of Orthodoxy in this period was the conversion of Rome and bringing the Balkans and Rome into the church. The low point was the fall of Constantinople. the rise of the Ottoman Empire, the Ottoman Turks. They were the most aggressive and the most organized Muslim or Islam rule, and they, you know, were not defeated until, what, 1918? That's when the Ottoman Empire was finally crushed at the end of World War I. But this map will show that the Ottomans, this was their original area. They charged, they took Constantinople in 1453, and they expanded their rule to all of this area, all the Balkans, Greece, all fell by the end of the 15th century and was in the control of the Ottomans. Further west, the history of the Roman Catholic Church was unfolding. Well, you can summarize this period and talk about the consolidation of Christianity in the West. In the West, it can be called a period that you could describe as the word Christendom. What does Christendom actually mean? Easiest way to describe Christendom is the union of church and state and culture. If you lived in this period and you thought of yourself, you didn't think of yourself as a Frenchman. You did maybe, but you were a part of the church, you were a part of the state, you were a part of the culture, and it was all intertwined. And it was called just by the phrase Christendom. Okay? What was this? How can you describe Christendom? In this period, you had a consolidation of Christianity and culture under the concept of Christendom, and it ended with a breakup of that concept with the Reformation. When you think of Roman Catholicism in this third 500-year period, you can think of diversity. Sometimes we think of Catholicism as a unified, a monolithic force, yet there were all sorts of people and all sorts of ideas found in the church at that time. You could read the Canterbury Tales, and the people that are described in there are churchmen. A lot of them are very associated with the church. They're different characters. They're different views of the church and salvation, but they were all within the scope of the Roman Catholic Church. Diversity. Struggles with Islam. Struggles with Islam, as we've mentioned, did not go away. The struggles with Islam, this at 732, this is a period. The struggles with Islam, even though they had been defeated at the Battle of Tours, they controlled Spain. This grieved Western Christians. They controlled the Holy Land. That really grieved Western Christians. Well, what are you going to do? What are you going to do about the Holy Land? Tell you what we're going to do. We're going to go get it back. So the Western Church, for a century and a half, entered into a period of the Crusades. The Crusades, this is just the map of the First Crusade, in essence was, I think I like Dr. Calhoun's words, he says, this was a disastrous period for Western Christianity. We're going to do a whole lesson on the Crusades in 2 weeks when I return, hopefully. For about a century and a half, the churches in the West were engaged in one crusade after another. They were military adventures into the East in order to attempt to defeat the Muslims militarily and to reconquer Jerusalem and other sites dear to the hearts of Western Christians. All of that did nothing to strengthen Christianity. It did much to heighten the antagonism between the Muslims and the Christian faith. Are the Muslims justified in their jihad against all other peoples today because we marched, I'm using that word in a very loose, collective way, we marched on them for a century and a half. Are they justified? We'll ask and answer that question or attempt to answer it in 2 weeks. Personally, I don't think they are. But this is a very low, I think a very low point of the operation of the church is the Crusades. But we'll have a lesson on that later. Along with the struggle of Islam, under Catholicism, you had the problem of the investiture controversy. I call it the lay investiture controversy. This really is a situation of the balance between church and state. Who has the authority? Who has control? Who is going to appoint the bishops? The Pope wanted to do this and thought he had the right to do it. The king said, no, no, I have the right to appoint the bishops. So particularly in England, in France, in Germany, you had this conflicting of the king claiming he should do it, the pope claiming he should do it. Each claimed authority over the other. We'll talk about in more detail this struggle between the pope, between the emperor and the pope, which really had been going on since the time of Constantine. There were some great achievements in Roman Catholicism at this time. One of them was Goff. Do you know that they have found documents and they found something that indicates that there's a drawing or an etching that shows someone with a stick-like thing whacking something. His swing looked about as bad as mine, probably, of an object, and they described it. They didn't call it Goff, but you know, that could be one of the greater developments of this third 500 years. Another was a good development in theology. There was the rise of scholasticism that ended up in the greatest theological work being produced for this era, and one of the greatest in the history of the church, the Summa by Thomas Aquinas. I have had trouble in the past getting I think a lot of people have trouble getting their arms around Thomas Aquinas. That's kind of a stupid statement. I've had trouble getting through the first sentence and, you know, scratching the error of this, but I'm committed to a lesson on Thomas and on the Summa and on scholastic theology in about 4 weeks, and I hope that I do better at it this time than I did the last time I tried to do that. It was a great, great accomplishment. It's probably one of the greatest books of systematic theology ever written, was the Summa. R.C. Sproul loves Thomas. R.C. Sproul is so much smarter than me that, you know, he can understand Thomas. We'll see. There was a rise in piety. You could call it a great period of piety for several reasons. The monastic orders were revived, and we're going to that's what you're going to hear next week in Dr. Calhoun's lecture, all about the monastic orders, about the revival in the orders of like the Benedictines, who had been in existence since the 5th century, but under Bernard of Clairvaux, they were actually revived. And then the new orders that came on, the Cistercians, then the Franciscans, and the Jesuits. He'll all talk about that next week. The popular piety of the people was increased, and it was subverted by error. Increased, there was mystic writings. Some nuns had written some things that were complementary to a separated life and a contemplation of Christ. But increasingly, the people's piety was tied up by sacramentalism. It was tied up in crass and mechanical ways of venerating Mary, etc., like this. The general culture at the time was influenced by the rise of universities. By the 12th century, this had happened. The first schools had come out of the monasteries where the monks were teaching, preserving learning and teaching the sons of nobles. Then in the areas of where the cathedrals were, you would have cathedral schools, and then out of the cathedral schools, the rise of the universities in Milan, in Paris, in Oxford, etc., like that, and we'll have a lesson on that coming up. You also had a building of churches or a building of cathedrals during this time. Charles should teach this lesson, but we'll come back to this a little later. But at the beginning of this period, you had the Romanesque form of architecture, which was, could it be described as heavy, Charles? Square? Ponderous?
Very little detail.
Very little detail. And the Romanesque was replaced by the Gothic.
Huh?
We're not doing Baroque. We're on the fast track. We're going from the Romanesque to the Gothic. How about that? There's a picture of a Gothic cathedral. Much more detail, and particularly the detail in there. Here's a drawing of a cross-section of the flying buttresses like that. And with this, it allow you to have light and height and you had an expanse in there like this. Could you not come into that and feel lifted up and worship God? And would it not be easier to worship God in light with a ceiling that way than something that was dark and morose? Architecture came to the Gothic. That's in this period. And we will revisit that. Along with the building great churches, it was a wonderful time for literature. Now, I would be the last person to talk about literature. Two of the things that are different but are both produced that we know about today is Chaucer's Canterbury Tales and Dante's Divine Comedy. Along with the development of literature, a wonderful time of literature, this third 500-year period might be called something that we would not imagine. We today, most of us would not think of this period as a time of reform. But yet there was attempts to reform within the church at this time. You had the papal-induced reform. This is Gregory the Seventh here. Gregory the Seventh wanted to strengthen, invigorate, and clean up the church. He wanted to set it on a better foundation. The reforms during his reign were notable. He tried to do away with some of the financial and moral concerns of the church. He established clerical celibacy. It's the first time that this practice of celibacy became a requirement rather than a recommendation. He found so much corruption that his only way to deal with it was to call for celibacy. Another time of reform was the Lateran Council of 1215. This was an attempt before the Reformation to get the church back on the right track. The council met in Rome. It dealt with some important doctrinal issues. Does anyone remember several weeks ago we mentioned something that was finally firmed up in the doctrine of the church at the Lateran Council?
Transubstantiation.
The doctrine of transubstantiation, which had been batted about since the 8th century, Radamus and Redemus, remember that? Well, yeah, you shouldn't remember them, but anyway, they were two guys who wrote for and against transubstantiation. It became the established doctrine of the Roman Church from 1215 on. If you adhered to the catechism of the church, you accepted the doctrine of transubstantiation. Difficult, no doubt about it. The Fourth Lateran Council also said that every Catholic should go to confession. How often do you reckon they call for confession? Once a year. In this period, not only was it a time of reform, but it was a development of the orders. I mentioned that, the Benedictines, St. Benedict, Revivals, Renewals, Bernard of Clairvaux, the Cistercians. By the way, that Romanesque church that I showed you earlier, that was the church of Avesi, where Bernard of Clairvaux preached up the Second Crusade. So when we deal with the Crusades, and we'll talk about it, I'll show you that picture again, but that's the very church that he preached up the Second Crusade. That is, calling the people to enter into and engage in the Second Crusade was in that Romanesque chapel. You had the rise of the Cistercians, the Dominicans, the Franciscans, and Dr. Calhoun will talk about them next week. It was a time of heresy. Now, the church, the official church, recognized different groups, and they called them heretical. One of them was the Cathars, or the Cathari, which existed in southern France and in Lombardy, which is northern Italy, all the way down to the Papal States. The Cathars, we would agree with the church, was a real heresy. The Cathars were dualistic. They were Manichaean-style religious expression. They were dominated a large part of this area. The church did everything it could to put it down, largely using force. The word heretic in the 13th century almost always referred to the Cathars, and they did use force and brutal force to put it down. We'll talk about this a little later. There were other people, however, that the church called heretic that we would not. We would find these people to be our brethren. The Waldensians in the Alpine area of northern Italy, the Waldensians will have a lesson on in a few weeks on the Waldensians and other reformers from this period. Wycliffe in the area of Wessex in England, the Lollards, his followers, people who were translating the scriptures into the language of the people, were preaching free grace. From Wycliffe, you also had the rise of John Huss in Bohemia, the pastor of Bethlehem Chapel, the preaching of the message of grace, called to the Council of Constance in 1415, thought that he was going to be able to defend his doctrine, but rather than that, they burned him at the stake, July 6, 1415. Wonderful story of Huss. We'll deal with him. In Italy, you had Girolamo Savonarola in Florence. Savonarola, again, a preacher of grace who ended up in 1498 giving his life at the stake. So this was a time of heresy, but part of the heresy were our brethren. It was heresy for the church, but it wasn't heresy for the truth. What about the message of the gospel? What about it? Was the gospel in any form of clarity being preached at this time? I think it's right to say that the gospel had become mixed and muddled in the 4th century, but with Augustine, there was a clear gospel doctrinal presentation that we could agree with. There was grace in Augustine. Unfortunately, after the time of Augustine, through the Middle Ages, this message of the salvation by grace would be lost. There were a few places, such as Gottschalk, such as Wycliffe, such as Huss, where this was preached, grace was preached, but these people were viewed as heretics by the Western Church. Most of the preaching of this period, from the standpoint of the Reformers, which we would agree with, was quite defective because of something called the sacramental system or sacramentalism. We will have a lesson on this, and we will call it doing all that man can do, because that is the essence of sacramentalism, doing what man can do. Most of the preaching was defective, the sacramental system, but I think we can say that even though the messengers often got the message wrong, with the emphasis in the wrong place, they were preaching the Bible. They used the Bible. God has a way of working through defective means, very defective means, of getting his message across. We cannot say that for 1,000 years no one was saved. Some people have said that. They've taken a very hard line position. I do not believe that it happened that way. It may be that some people whom we know nothing about were preaching a purer gospel. Primarily, we only know about the theologians, the patriarchs, the popes, because they got to write theologies and histories. But while their theology was defective, there could have been a message spread amongst the common people that was more of a message of grace. I don't know. I just have trouble imagining that for 1,000 years, the Lord was not converting and continuing to build his church, mixed as it may have been and muddled as it may have been. Because remember, the Reformation and the Reformers came out of this church. They came out of this. Now, did they renounce the sacramental system? Yes. But they came out of this church. Maybe the people had a purer message than the theologians. Maybe the people got it right and the theologians got it wrong. The question for today, though, is the question that Doug asked when he did the first survey of the second 500 years. In medieval days, convulsion, confusion hindered the church. Today, peace and prosperity hinders the church. How is success achieved in either case? As our tall brother with the slow accent challenged us a few months ago when he was here that Wednesday night, what are we going to do in the lap of luxury in which we live? Are we going to be content? Man, that's a challenge. I'm sure it bothers you. I can't say I don't know if it doesn't bother you, because I know if you're in this church, you are concerned about your witness and you're concerned about your walk. We are concerned about it. How do we balance? Money's not bad. Prosperity is not bad, but we've got to use prosperity for the influence of culture and the spread of the gospel. Well, next week we're going to do on loving God, medieval monasticism. Any of you who are reading in Professor Gonzalez, I'll try to send you this, but chapter 26 pages 238 to 242, 29, and 31 deal with this. I'll send that out in the email. Thank you so much. Appreciate your time and attention.